In this part of Focus, we will spend some time exploring the life story of an American icon, someone who arguably deserves the title of Mother of Our Nation. And when I tell you who it is, it might be a little surprising to you. The person we're going to be talking about this morning is Pocahontas, someone who probably in the popular imagination, in the minds of a lot of people, forever remains a girl, a young girl. But our guest for the program today, Paula Gunn Allen, says that we really need to see Pocahontas for the powerful woman that she was. She was a priestess and medicine woman. She also was an extraordinary ambassador who formed groundbreaking relations between her people and the British. And indeed, says our guest, truly deserves the title Mother of Our Country. Paula Gunn Allen is one of this country's foremost Native American literary critics. She's also professor emerita of English at UCLA and is credited with being the founder of the field of American Indian Literary Studies. She has lectured widely, received many awards, among them the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Indian Writers Association and the Hubble Prize for Lifetime Achievement in American Literary Studies from the Modern Language Association. She's author of a book that we'll be talking about here this morning. It's out and now in paperback. It's titled Pocahontas, Medicine Woman, Spy, Entrepreneur, Diplomat. And it is published by Harper San Francisco. If you would like to read it, you should certainly seek it out in the bookstore or possibly in the library. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. We invite anybody into the conversation. The only thing we ask is that people are brief. We ask that so that we could keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But certainly we want to involve listeners in the conversation. And you can do that very easily by calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Allen, hello.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Good.
Very good. Well, I appreciate you being with us. We certainly do. You begin talking about your approach to this entire project, and saying that this is it is not, and it is certainly not. If people read the book, it is not a conventional biography. And you said, and you deliberately set out to do something different because you felt that the subject demanded it. Perhaps that would be a place that we can start, and to talk a little bit about how it is that you approached telling the story.
You know, I've believed since I was a young writer that form is an expression of content. In fact, I'm almost convinced that form, that the content is an expression of form. In other words, the content isn't nearly as important as the form. So if I had done an academic historiography or standard biography, what would happen, even worse than it does happen, because I've got a kind of hybrid style going here, is that Pocahontas would become a white girl. And she would be a sort of modern middle-class American with feathers. And that's exactly what must not happen. You know, we recontextualize historical figures and we put them in our world frame. As a consequence of that exact habit, ever since John Smith, who was her first biographer, or the first man who mentioned her, what happened was she got recontextualized. And the problem for me then was, okay, given the way the native oral tradition works, and I've spent most of my life studying it in various forms, that is to say various tribes, various First Nations, it doesn't work the same way that the linear academic structure does. You don't use footnotes either. But so the problem was, how do I get the story to at least reflect that she's an Algonquin 17th century woman and not a 20th century girl living in Virginia? And essentially that was the problem. Then there was the other problem, of course, with overcoming all of the, bad press, some of it deliberate and some of it more accidental, to recast her as a sex object for little Johnny Smith, who thought of himself as the swain of the world.
Well, it you know, in looking at the book and just looking around, doing a little surfing, looking at what kind of histories are available of who this woman was, it certainly seems that the details, there's a sort of a standard set of details that can fill maybe a page or two.
Right.
And of course they are problematic because much of this comes from European writers. A lot of it comes from Captain Smith, who arguably didn't really quite understand what it was he was in the middle of. So it makes one wonder, what is it that we can say for certain? I mean, there are some things we can say, you know, where it was she was born, the people to whom she was born, approximately when she was born, where and when she died, those sorts of things.
That we know she existed.
We know. And we know that, in fact, yes, she existed. She was a real person. But what sort of things can one say for sure about her?
Not much. That's why it's very important to understand the Powhatan people, and to understand their position in 17th century history from their point of view, not from a European point of view, who they thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not that hard to do because there's an awful lot of living Indian and Indian traditions. I mean, we didn't go away, even though American history tends to think we did. In fact, modern casinos are just an extension of the old tribal world, believe it or not. Gambling has always been important in every tribe I've ever heard of. In fact, there's a god, gambler god, who's practically ubiquitous on the American landscape. So even that doesn't vary much from traditional ways. So actually, we know a great deal if we look, and this was where my research problem was, we have to look at the Algonquin. I don't know or didn't know much about the Algonquin because I was born and raised out west. I'm Laguna Pueblo. And because of that, of course, I've got a certain bias in my research. So I had to learn about the Algonquin people on the East Coast, and not only the northern Algonquins around, you know, up north of the Potomac, but also the southern ones, which was a little more problematic because there's fewer of them. By the way, I should say that I came to find out that there's a perfectly good, rather large sample of members of the Powhatan Alliance alive and thriving in Virginia around the old Jamestown.
Well, perhaps you said you felt that perhaps a key to understanding her and who she was in understanding the Powhatan people and who they thought they were.
Yes.
So perhaps you can talk a little bit more about that.
Okay. Well, they were really interesting. For one thing, the Algonquins themselves are fascinating people. They were all the way from Alberta around Edmonton or toward the B.C., what would it be, Washington border. And they extended all the way to Maine and north of there and all the way south to Carolina, down the Ohio, not to mention the Mississippi and so on. This was a vast complex, and it was a great civilization. Okay, so then when the Europeans came, of course, the Europeans thought they were the great civilization, but the Algonquins knew their own history, and they knew their own religion and its spiritual traditions. And so they thought that they were extremely powerful people. However, they also had a prophecy that told them that when the third group of strangers, they didn't say blonde and bearded, they didn't say that at all. It could have been another group of Indian people as we know them today. They didn't know them that way then. There weren't any Indians. But when the third group came and settled in the Chesapeake Bay area, which is the location we're talking about, that would be their ruin and destruction. And they apparently, and I'm using English and American historiography, coming from a colonial, a very early colonial named William Strachey, who was there during Pocahontas' lifetime and was taking down stories from the existing and still quite powerful Powhatan people. Anyway, they had had this prophecy for at least 100 years, if not longer. Now, because they were people who were deeply spiritual, and by that I mean magical, it's easier to understand them if you read fantasy literature, even if you read Harry Potter, than if you read all of the stuff that goes on about the Indian world, anthropology and politics, and you just don't get it. It's not in any modern thinking, but it is in old-time thinking. It's right, sitting right there in English or German legends, by the way, because they had the same worldview. It's just in the 17th century they were beginning to go into a different worldview. And so they thought that they were very powerful people, but that they were at their end. And which I'm sure didn't help matters when the English showed up and it turned out that they were the ones. So what the Powhatans did was they tried to adopt them in their own system. They tried to, through John Smith, they tried to bring the English people, the few people who had come over, because they thought they were going to find gold, the men, I think they were almost all men, to incorporate them into the Powhatan Alliance. To do that, the council, the Great Medicine Council, that was at the time based in a town called Wiricomico, which has recently, by the way, just surfaced again, just when my book came out, in fact. And they were there at Wiricomico, and the people that, you know, the movers and shakers of the Powhatan Alliance were there. They decided that the thing to do was to adopt these strangers into their alliance and have them abide by their laws and their traditions, and then everything would work out. Well, of course, it didn't work out because the English didn't know they were being adopted. John Smith thought he was being murdered, or an attempt was being made. Or he seems to have thought that, and I should qualify that. In general, the English weren't there to get adopted. They were there to find gold because they were representatives of something called the Virginia Company, and this was an early international business corporation. One of the first multinationals. So, I mean, their agendas couldn't have been more different. Nevertheless, the Powhatans thought that they could, by using their systems, they could incorporate this new group of people, and everything would be fine. They used Pocahontas as one of their many tools. She was a good one. She was brilliant.
Let me just take a moment here to introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're speaking with Dr. Paula Gunn Allen. She is Professor Emerita of English at UCLA and is credited with being the founder of the field of American Indian Literary Studies, has received many awards and honors for her work. She is the author of a book that is out now in paper, which is titled Pocahontas, Medicine Woman, Spy, Entrepreneur, Diplomat. It is an unconventional biography of this woman and her significance in the history of this country. It's published by Harper San Francisco, and if you're interested, you can go out and look for the book. And, of course, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The event that you just described, that is the idea that the Powhatan people saw the Europeans as a threat and saw, well, perhaps the way to deal with the threat was to make them, make that is the Europeans, one of them, sort of bring them into the family, as it were, is a completely different view of this story, the one that we have heard about Captain John Smith and Pocahontas, that comes down to us, I suppose, in part, it comes from him about his.
It all comes from him.
It comes from him about how he was captured, about how he thought he was going to be executed, and about how this young girl who apparently had a crush on him or some such thing.
And she was the Princess Powhatan, the great Powhatan's daughter.
His daughter, the daughter of the chief, and just at the moment where he felt he was being held down and he felt any moment here someone was going to club him to death, out comes Pocahontas and she throws herself over him, in between him and the executioners, and then he is saved because the chief said, well, whatever Pocahontas wants, she can have, and she doesn't want this man to be killed, so we will spare him. That sounds like that may, as you say, may indeed have been what John Smith thought was happening, but it, in fact, was not what
was
happening.
It was not what was happening. There, the initiation rituals that they had at the time required, well, it's sort of like baptism. You die and then you're born again. And so you had to die as a stranger. They didn't really think of Europe. They didn't even get Europe. It was just everybody was here. So let's say they were all Indians in their from their point of view. They did think the English had a great deal of power, and I mean powa, or medicine, if you will, which is a word I hate, but there it is. So they thought that they were incredibly good wizards. but they didn't think of them as, ah, strangers from across the sea. They just weren't thinking that way. So anyway, what happened was there's this huge gathering in this huge lodge that was 200 feet long, according to the archaeologists who are presently digging things around there, and maybe 50 feet wide, big hall. And all of the mucky mucks of all of the villages around, of the whole alliance, were there. And they were called queens and kings because that's what the English called them in English, not chiefs. And, of course, nowadays we think there were no chieftainesses, but that is wrong. The women were very powerful. I must say, these people were matrilineal, matrifocal, matrilocal, if you will, matriarchal. Mm-hmm. She could not have been Wahasanaquk's daughter. That's called Powhatan, excuse me, by the English, but that was his title, not his name. Anyway, it's sort of like referring to Elizabeth as queen and thinking that's her name. It's not. So she could not have been Powhatan's daughter. Now, Paula Gunn Allen is saying this. There's other historians, even Powhatans, who I think disagree with me. And I should make that clear. It's just that where I come from, we're also matriarchal. And you get your identity through your mother's clan, not through your father's clan. So this is important because her father wouldn't have listened to her had he been her father. I think he might have been her uncle. Certainly, he was the head of the whole state. He was a very, very great shaman, a very great wizard, apparently so powerful. People were, you know, a little afraid of him. And they also kind of thought, I mean, he was sacred. He was to be very greatly respected. So he's presiding at this great gathering. And at this time, all of the people, including women, the matrons, as they're called, were all there. And he was brought in, and at some point, a couple of young men grabbed him, threw him down, put his head on a stone. Well, this is a sacred stone, by the way, and it has to do with making him symbolically die. So then he hears what he calls a shriek, and this young woman, very young, 11 years old, she's not really a woman, but she's all decked out with down feathers in her hair, so we know that she was a woman, a girl who was being trained in the priesthood, and that's how we know. And so, anyway, she flings herself on this fellow, and she's howling something, as he puts it. Well, the shriek is probably, there's a particular tremolo that they do. We still do it. I can't, because I can't breathe well enough to do it. But anyway, we still do it. I'm sure that's what she was doing. This is all very ritualized. So then she's done that, which I think symbolically makes her his mother, or if you will, his keeper. She's only 11. And so that's a little dicey, my assumption here. It's just that the role she played seems to indicate that in some way she was responsible to the Powhatan people, to the council particularly, for what John did. So anyway, then everybody starts conversing. This is again according to John Smith. And there's this long conversation that goes on, and then they sit him up, and then they disperse. And the next day, he meets with Powhatan. He's given a new name, Nanakoke. He's told, this is your new name. And then he's taken back to the English settlements. He has some escorts, who aren't really guards. They're really escorts. And then the story unfolds from there. Hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about Pocahontas and her job, in a sense, her role within her people, particularly her sacred role?
Love to. As near as I can tell, well, there's an institution that I first heard of among the Cherokee, and the Cherokee were neighbors of the Southern Powhatans. So I don't know if the Southern Powhatans borrowed this from the Cherokee or the other way around. But there's an institution that's known in English as Beloved Woman. And that, it's an office. And it's the only, this can only be done by women. This office can only be held by women. And one of the terms of that office is that you get to decide life or death of a captive. In fact, it's your responsibility. It's not privilege. It's obligation. So because she came out of the group, there were quite a few young women dressed like her with the down in their hair. And then another group of young women who didn't have down in their hair, Anyway, she comes out, and I think that, I know the down in her hair signifies beloved woman because they're always with a white feather, and it's white down. In fact, she's always depicted with white feathers, interestingly enough. Even as an adult, the one engraving there is of her, she's holding a white feather fan. It's her staff of office, if you will. So when she comes out, what she's doing is saying to the assembled, not just to the king or emperor, as the English also called him, but to everybody, all the heads of every village are there, and of every different tribe that's part of this alliance, they're all there. And she's saying, or if you will, the Manitou are saying, okay, he's adopted. He's adoptable, really. And so they went on with the rest of the ceremony, and he was installed as the chief or king of his people. And then he was supposed to go back to the Englishmen and teach them how to live like good Algonquins, which, of course, he didn't do. One of the reasons we know this is because years later, he disappeared, and she didn't know that he had gone back to England. She thought he'd been killed. The English were on the verge of hanging him, by the way, for sedition. So he damn near was killed, but he escaped by some odd circumstances. And then later, it was an accident on his boat, and his friends took him back to England because he was so badly wounded when some gunpowder exploded. So years later, she's in England, and she's the toast of the town, and all the lords and ladies and all the writers and all the cognoscenti, even the court, are receiving her. So he finally goes to see her, and she makes him wait for, I don't know, maybe an hour. And then she finally comes out into the reception room of her quarters and laces into him. And she lets him know what's happening. Well, he decides to interpret that as a woman scorned. But all you have to do is read the words. What she tells him is that he betrayed Powhatan, and he betrayed his word. And when she came to his country, if he was there, and he was supposed to take care of her as his daughter, just as her father had taken care of, or just as Powhatan, she didn't say my father, had taken care of him as his son. And that's probably the clearest evidence that an adoption exchange in traditional Algonquin terms was what had transpired. He, of course, completely misreads it, and I don't think he's being obtuse, though he was very, very into making himself look like a grand swashbuckling hero. But I don't think he was being obtuse. I think that's, he didn't know. Hmm. And he just didn't think of it. Adoption was not something that Europeans did, at least not that way.
Well, I think it's interesting. It makes me to think about the this interesting intersection between the personal and the political, in the sense that things that are seen as political alliances are also are cemented as family alliances.
That's right. That's right. You know what she did was John Smith disappears. She disappears for 3 years. That's because she's going through menarche. And when she emerges again into English history, she's dressed as a woman, not as a girl. So we know that she went through this. We also know that to do that, she had to do several things. To become a full-fledged medicine woman or priestess, priestess really is what we're talking about, because it was a training and a whole discipline and years of schooling, and extremely, extremely complex. So anyway, we know that she had went through these things, which are marriage, and it was thought that she was married, but the English didn't want to believe it. And his name was Comocomes, and I think she had a child, at least one, because in the tradition, you don't become a full-grown woman until you've had at least one child. But once you've done that, you become a free agent. Well, she was in a village acting as a corn, excuse me, a corn agent for the medicine council. And then the English came and they abducted her, or at least they thought they abducted her. And she goes off back to James Fort, which actually was not Jamestown, it was James Fort. And then a couple of them manage to get a thing going where they take her north. This is Puritans, and there's this fight going on in England between the Puritans and what will eventually become the Anglicans about who's going to dominate. And the fight was over whether the church would be part of the state or would not be part of the state. the Puritans did not want the state involved in religion. So, by the way, the reason that we have separation of church and state in this country is not to keep the church out of state business, it's to keep the state out of church business. And that's also why religious corporations are set up like they are, no interference from the state. So back to the 17th century, she married a man named John Rolfe. And he was a planter. He was also a tobacco addict. And here's where the story gets absolutely fascinating. I think what she did was she got herself abducted. She goes back to among the English because her mission isn't finished. She puts a spell on this guy because through tobacco. To them, tobacco is a sacred and very powerful substance. And it's what connects us directly to the other world, of the Manitou, the mysteries, or the little mysteries, as they call it. All right, so what happens then is she can use tobacco magic, and I give an example of a chant, to get him to fall hopelessly in love with her. What we know is the effect. There's no record says she did an enchantment, but there is a record that says he himself thought he was enchanted. He was absolutely besotted. He couldn't get her out of his mind, out of his dreams, out of his anything. And he was really frightened because he didn't want to marry a pagan and get thrown out of English society. Not that he was particularly well connected, but nevertheless, he was a commoner. And she was a princess, by the way. She was royalty, and he was common blood, which later on would antagonize King James, because commoners don't marry royalty, and he presumed to marry royalty. At any rate, he writes this down, that he is so besotted, he thinks it's the devil. So then he decides, okay, I'm going to go for 3 days without seeing her, having anything to do with her. And then if I'm still obsessed, he doesn't use that exact word, besotted, I think is the word he uses, that will be that it's a sign from God. And so, you know, the rule of three in English magical tradition. And so then that's what happens. And so then he asks, who is the guy? He's the marshal. Their head man, instead of being called a governor, was called a marshal. I think it was Burke, Marshall Burke, asks him to arrange a marriage, if it's okay with the company, for him to marry this woman, who's, by the way, her name is Matoaka. She's no longer known as Pocahontas because she's not a child. And when she becomes a Christian, which she also did, she gave her name Matoaka to the English. And in exchange, she took an English name, Rebecca. And that's a kind of interesting choice of names. Whoever made the choice. So now she's Lady Rebecca, and then she marries John Rolfe, so she becomes Lady Rebecca Rolfe. He is not sir. He's not aristocracy in any sense of the word. So this part of the story tells me that, wait a minute, tobacco was the entire thing. What I find out is that tobacco raised more money for Spain than gold and silver and slaves ever did. Tobacco. And then it turns out that because tobacco was the first planted crop, the first plantations in what's now the United States were tobacco plantations, and that was the first exported crop, and it's what built the English holdings in this country. So as near as I can tell, because it's a sacred drug, probably the most sacred, according to some Algonquin stories, it comes directly from the head of Earth Mother, if you will. She's called First Mother, not Earth Mother. And it's what she gave us to stay connected with her. And there's all these stories all over Algonquin country, from far north to far south and so on. And they never did anything sacred that they didn't use tobacco, either smoking it, just burning it on the fire, or throwing it into the water if they were fishing, or in some way using it, because they were asking the Manitou to intervene to make things happen the way they wanted them to happen. So it was a magical powder, if you will. She uses this magical powder to get John. She and the Powhatan, I think it was probably young people from Wiracomico, come and help him as he develops Virginia tobacco. Virginia tobacco begins to outsell Spanish tobacco, hands down. And it takes maybe 100 years. But it takes over the world and begins to build the English Empire. By the way, it's also the product that allows the English stock market, which was faltering and was way, way lower than the Amsterdam market, it allows it eventually to gain ascendancy. And to this day, the pound is the most stable bit of money in the whole world. Hmm.
It's a fascinating story. I suppose that there are some people who do, who say maybe you're making a few leaps, but but it is a fascinating story.
It's fascinating. The research was so compelling. I knew that tobacco had been important because I knew about the plantation system. I had no idea that the story of the coming of the Europeans to this part of the world was all about tobacco. I had no idea. Now, from an otherworldly point of view, which, by the way, is the point of view I live in, I don't live in the other one, to tell you the truth. I know how to use it, but I don't particularly believe in, you know, all I want is the facts, ma'am. It all depends on what you're just defining as fact. Mind you, I have a PhD, so I know that there aren't any facts. It just depends on spin, so here you go. I'm giving this an Algonquin spin, which doesn't make it false. In fact, it doesn't even make my leaps. It just makes them not Anglo-European academic, and that's an important distinction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making Indian leaps, and that upsets some people. Some people don't mind. The Powhatans, who I went to do a book thing with and a reading, they thought it was wonderful, by the way. And they've invited me to participate in the Virginia Book Festival this year. So I know that in Indian country, I'm fine. It's the academics and perhaps very political activist Indians who I'm offending, but oh well. In any case, it seems that then tobacco, the Manitou, it's not an object, it's a being. For whatever reason, it was time that these two worlds come together, and this is an Indian story. So the old world, which is the Eastern Hemisphere, had to come to the Western Hemisphere because that's what time it was. And that's mainly the story I'm telling, is the story of what time it was in 1607 when the two came together.
I should introduce again our guest, and we have a couple of callers who'd like to join in the conversation. Our guest is Paula Gunn Allen. She is Professor Emerita of English at UCLA, one of the country's foremost Native American literary critics. In fact, she's credited as being the founder of the field of American Indian Literary Studies. She has lectured widely, has received many awards and honors for her work. And the book that we have been talking about here is published by Harper San Francisco. It's now out in paperback. If you would like to read it, it's titled Pocahontas, Medicine Woman, Spy, Entrepreneur, Diplomat. And we do have some questions here and a couple of people ready to go. We'll start off in over in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for pointing out that the separation of church and state was not to protect state from the church, but was to protect the church from the state. And almost to prove that truth, in our nation's capital, in the Capitol Rotunda, the rotunda wall is lined with huge paintings, mm-hmm. and one of those paintings is the baptism of Pocahontas.
That's true. I forgot that. Yes, yes.
Can you comment on that painting, and I'll listen to your answer off the air.
Thank you very much.
Well, do you have something to say about that?
I've got lots to say about that. Until very recently, there's never been a candidate for president who didn't run with Indian authorization. That is to say, on the campaign trail, they show up with somebody in full regalia and the eagle headdress that the Plains Indians wear. And what happens when you look at this picture in the Capitol Rotunda, well, there's a bunch of things, but just out front, what happens is you look at this and go, oh, it's okay for us to be here. An Indian woman said so. Got that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really powerful. By the way, American women are way ahead of other women in the world in terms of our social status. We're still behind, but we're way ahead. And that's because Indian women they were not only equal, but in some respects they were dominant. They were the economic force, not men, which really annoyed the priests, the Jesuits who came. At any rate, that tells us that the Europeans married this continent. It's interesting that the European is the male, and the female is this continent. By the way, the English had intended to name what we now call the United States and Canada. They had intended to name that Virginia after the Virginia.
After Queen Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it tells us. But it also tells us that that religion is part and parcel of this country. I think there's more than that I want to say. Is I think that it also, once you know who Pocahontas represented, who Lady Rebecca really was, then you begin to understand that advertently or inadvertently, the, quote, founding fathers, unquote, understood the powers that they were dealing with. I know they did because Washington, D.C. was built by Masons and it was constructed a particular way for magical reasons. And we may not give any credence to those things these days, but they did in the 17th century. They built the capital on the Potomac. And the Potomac is the sacred river of the Powhatan people. They built it in the headwaters of the Potomac. And the Powhatan thought that the Potomac was the most Manitou-filled river of all their rivers, and they had quite a few all the way to the Rappahannock. So the source of their power to dream, Powhatan means great dreamer. And when we have powwow today, it's an Algonquin term, and it means we dream together. So Potomac or Powhatan, anything that's got P-O, Pocahontas, it means this particular kind of otherworldly power, if you will, ability. Maybe it's magnetism. Who knows?
Let's talk with someone else here. We have a listener in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. Dr. Gunn-Arland, I just have to say that I feel very lucky to be hearing you on a local broadcast. I am very much influenced by your earlier work and you, in a way, as an academic in training myself, to recognize just your influence in terms of being a pioneer in diplomat in your own right. I wanted to sort of ask a couple of questions, and if either to have you respond or to see if you were aware, and that is the statistical information that you just gave about the tension between British and Spanish tobacco is very much a part of my own research. But I wanted to see if you realize that there is a distinction that happens between the type of tobacco cultivated by the British and the type of tobacco cultivated by the Spanish, which is blonde, burly, and various other types, as well as black tobacco, which is predominantly used for cigar and or pipe, and in some cases chewing tobaccos.
Mm-hmm.
And that the magical purposes among the indigenous people of what is now present-day North America and the indigenous people of continental South America and the Caribbean, including sort of the syncretic Afro-New World slaves as well, it takes on very similar ritual meaning in their use.
Mm. I didn't know that.
Okay.
Oh, I did know that the sense that tobacco was this powerful product, as we would call it today, was widespread on both continents and in the Caribbean. I did know that, but I didn't know that it then began to infuse other religions.
Yes. And then the other question that I wanted to ask you is just about where your interpretation went. What is the purchase or value, if you will, of understanding or reading or interpreting John Smith and the British as being unaware or not conscious of a difference in the way in which power, status, and respect is delineated in the amongst the Powhatan people and other indigenous groups?
What is the point?
Yes, like what is the use and the value in seeing that rather than seeing them as conscious and perhaps dismissive?
Well, Smith could get dismissive because he was... Here's the interesting thing. England and Europe in general at the time was largely still living in the magical worldview. So all of the laborers that came with those ships believed in the oral tradition. So they believed that there were fairies, excuse me for using the word, leprechauns, pixies, brownies, all those folks. And they believed, actually I've met a whole lot of English people who still not only believe it, they see it happen anyway. So they believed in the same kind of world that the Powhatans believed in. However, there was this other group we know that this is about the time Francis Bacon is on the march. So we're getting something called a rational worldview, the scientific method, and these sorts of things. So what we know is that there's a growing group, and this grows right along with the free market, in case anybody's interested, that is into rationalism. And by the time we get to 1776, those particular thinkers had decided that God had left the universe and let it run for itself. And those particular, that point of view, does dismiss what it sees. And he leaves letters and records that tell us that he's dismissing it. But most of the English at the time didn't and wouldn't have. My point here is that there's no point in villainizing the Europeans in order to prove that Indians are innocent and the Europeans are the bad guys, and so, you know, then we should castigate them and hate them. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I'm not writing a political book in the normal sense of politics. What I'm writing is a book that's as close to accurate as I can get. So I don't know. I think accuracy in general is the way to go. And I think that blackguarding people, how do you say, I can't say the word right, villainizing whoever, it serves absolutely no purpose. So I suppose the reason that I should do that is because I think that that was the case.
We're getting very short on time, and there's something that I want to make sure that I give you the opportunity to talk about, because I think it's a really important idea that you're trying to put across with the book, and that is, first of all, that you say you are very concerned that people not see Pocahontas as a tragic figure,
yeah,
and that she has this very, very interesting role that comes from the fact that she, in effect, had one foot in two different worlds, that she was truly a bicultural figure, very much still a part, obviously, of her own people, of her own world, and yet she also provides this kind of bridge between it and between her people and the Europeans. And,
yeah,
and in the book that, in fact, that you write, that she was, as far as you're concerned, she was one of the earliest bicultural or mixed culture Indians of the East Coast.
Yeah. She was. Malinalli, down south 100 years before, is another example of Malinche, as she's called. Anyway, in Mexico. Anyway, Pocahontas, when she went to England, which is a whole other story, fascinating, she wanted to stay. She did not want to come home. Now, there's rumors in Indian country that the English court killed her. I can't think why they would. I'm perfectly willing to believe that John Rolfe had something to do with her early death, but I'm saying that because he wouldn't stay near her as she was dying. And the story was that he was too upset, too distressed, too brokenhearted. But this was a man in his 30s who had seen a lot of death, and I can't seriously give credence to that. In any event, she stayed. And I went looking for her in that way to see if I could find her, I don't know, her vibes, if you will. Well, they're not in Virginia. Where I found them was in Gravesend, where she's buried. And you can feel it. And what do I mean? I mean that as I got down by the river, and there's one small building left that was an armory at the time that she landed there and died. That building is still there. It's made of stone. And I'm standing there, and I get this feeling of, oh, isn't this beautiful? It's a sense of aesthetic satisfaction, I guess, is an objective way to put it. And that's how I know. I interpret that to mean, oh, she's still here. Her spirit is here. I also think that because she was so powerful, what she did was she anchored the Manitou spirit to England and allowed the bridge to go both ways. And then tobacco following, hey, it was, they did it. She did it. She did it.
I'm really interested in, you know, we talked just a second ago about her bicultural status, and you, I was interested that you would bring up the name of the woman who assisted the Spanish in conquering Mexico, whose name now is sort of synonymous with being a traitor. If you call someone a Malinchista, that's not a compliment.
That's among the what can I say? The radical activists.
Hmm.
And we're not talking about radical activism in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. It's just silly. Malinche, Malinalli was her name, overthrew the tyrant. She was a slave of the Aztecs. Now, what would you do if you had the opportunity? You're a slave.
Hmm. Well, I expect I would do the same.
Well, yeah. Malinalli wasn't in any position to think of the Spaniards as the stranger who were going to conquer Mexico. She knew the Aztecs not only enslaved people, but murdered them by the hundreds who were other Indians. They weren't Aztec citizens. They were really not nice people. So, by the way, it's the descendants of Aztecs who are really into this Malinista of whatever it is. La Chingada is how I learned it, and I won't translate that.
So, no, I guess the point is that no one would have accused Pocahontas of being disloyal.
Oh, yes, they have. Indeed, there's Indian activists, generally of the male persuasion, who think of her as a sellout, and who are very angry that she married an Englishman, became a Christian, and stayed in England, didn't want to come home. And she's a traitor to her people. There's a number of people who think the same thing of Sacagawea. And so from my early years as a scholar of Indian history and Indian history in America, one thing that fascinated me is the traitors are all women. How come Squanto's not a traitor? Fascinating.
What is the, is it significant, or as you explain in the book that Pocahontas was her child name, her baby name.
And, right, and I when keep she, calling her that.
When, well, everybody does, so that's that's how people know her. And you also explained that when she became a woman, when she made that transition from being a child to a woman, she got another name. And then when she was baptized and married John Rolfe, then she got yet another name. Is there some significance that we can't quite let go of her baby name, that it's her childhood name by which we continue to call her?
The infantilization of Native people. You know, we're simple and primitive, and oh, aren't we cute? And we're sweet and charming and And some of us are all those things, and some of us decidedly are not. In other words, Indians are people, too. And Europeans don't have the corner on the market of bad guys. By the way, one of the things I object to is our a tendency to valorize white people, not just Indians, but the radicals in general, and to think that the white world is far more powerful than it is. It's just not that powerful. The tsunami ought to give us a sort of a hint about how really powerful they are. I know how powerful they think they are, but I don't see why I should buy into their PR.
We're almost at the point where we're going to have to finish.
By the way, it was disease that got the native people. It wasn't war, in case you're interested.
The one last idea that I think I'm really quite fascinated with is, and it's difficult perhaps to as people of the 21st century to get yourself into the mindset of people of this century, but this idea that somehow that both the Europeans and the American Indians did have this idea that there were different spheres. There was the one in which we live, and then there was another one, another realm,
right.
That the two realms were separate, and yet they interacted.
Right. And, in England, you go across a river, usually.
And that in a sense, made it maybe a little easier for these two peoples to understand one another, because they sort of saw the world in the same way.
I believe that's true. And it's too bad that the public society of America went in another direction, or Canada, or for that matter, even Mexico, though not nearly so much. And so you see quite a few native worldviews and practices incorporated under Catholicism in Mexico that you don't see up here. I mean, it's really too bad that it got so separated, because there's a fundamental tendency among most of us, which is why we like fantasy, we like movies, we like books, just to know, or to at least believe, that there are, there's what you see and then there's what you don't see. I devote a fair amount of time to talking about David Bohm's theory of the implicate and explicate order. He's a quantum physicist. In my attempt to explain that if you want to be really rational, then, and you want to follow the scientific paradigm, then you have to see that 17th century or 15th century worldviews were more accurate than technological rationalistic points of view, in case anybody's interested.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, because we've simply used our time. The book is Pocahontas, Medicine Woman, Spy, Entrepreneur, Diplomat, published by Harper San Francisco, by our guest, Paula Gunn Allen. She's Professor Emerita of English at UCLA. And Professor Allen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.